Hello, welcome to the Donmar Warehouse's Climate Conversation Series. My name is Claire Slater. I'm the head of new work at the Donmar, and I am delighted to host this series of conversations between leading artists and leading climate and social justice thinkers. Our hope is that bringing these inspiring people together will help us all reconsider what it means to make theatre in the context of the climate crisis. These conversations have been curated by Zoe Svensson. Zoe is currently working as the Donmar's climate dramaturg. Her research is enabling us, our artists and our audiences, to take this step back and ask, how can the stories we tell and the ways we produce them contribute to a climate positive future? So joining me and Zoe today is Max Webster. Hi, Max.
Hi.
Max is an associate director at the Donmar, where he is just now, in the moment we're recording this conversation, opening Shakespeare's Henry V. Some of Max's other recent productions include The Spectacular Life of Pi, currently playing in the West End, The Lorax, which was a family show which invited children to consider their relationship with nature at the Old Vic, and As You Like It and Twelfth Night at the Regent's Park Open Air Theatre. Max's productions are always packed full of theatrical flair, design coups, and a sense of true magic, and I love them.
Thank you.
We're also delighted to be joined by Farah Karam Cooper, who is a professor of Shakespeare Studies at King's College London and a co-director of education at Shakespeare's Globe. Hi, Farah.
Hi.
She's currently writing a book on Shakespeare and race and is an executive board member of Race Before Race, a consortium of scholars and institutions that seek racial justice in the field of pre-modern literary studies. And we're also thrilled to be speaking with Indra Adnan. Hi, Indra.
Hi there.
Indra has been writing and network building on the themes of future politics, conflict and transformation, and the role of the arts in integral thinking for over 20 years. She is also a psychosocial therapist. Thank you all so much for joining us. Today we're talking about Max's production of Henry V and how it speaks to the climate crisis and its intersection with colonialism and capitalism. These are huge themes, intricately and historically linked. Max, can you tell us about your approach to this famous Shakespeare play and its famous eponymous hero? What was important for you to investigate in making this production?
Great. So Henry V tells a story of the Prince of England, who's called Hal, who is running away from his royal responsibility. So when the story starts in the Henry IV plays, which is kind of like the prequel to Henry V, if these Shakespeare history plays were a box set, Hal, or Henry, is in the East End of London, drinking a lot and running with a gang that steals purses and does highway robberies. And then his father dies quite suddenly, and he sobers up. He does what I guess nowadays you might think of as a 12-step program. He finds God, and he turns up as a newly formed righteous king at the beginning of the Henry V plays, and decides, on a slightly tenuous reason, based on some loose historical justification, to invade and conquer France. And the play charts his increasing conquest of France and how that happens, both through the military and then in the final culminating fifth act through a seduction or wooing scene of the French princess. So it's both a military and personal conquest of France. I always loved Henry V as a kid. I got the Kenneth Branagh film on VHS, I remember. It was a great birthday present. I was probably 11, and I stood on my parents' sofa waving a lightsaber around, pretending to be Kenneth Branagh or Henry V. And I thought it was marvellous that he conquered France, and I thought it was marvellous to be English, and marvellous that we used to conquer other countries. Luckily, you'll be pleased to know, my thinking has developed a bit since I was 11. And what at 11 I thought of as heroism, I would now call colonialism or imperialism. But I think those two perspectives are still very important, and I actually think they're there in Shakespeare's play. So there is a celebration of heroism in the play, and we have some of the most famous and powerful incitements to action written in the English language. But at the same time, in Shakespeare's play, and even more explicitly perhaps in the production we've tried to make of it, there is a critique of what that is, a critique of the flimsiness of the reasons for war, when is it ever justified to commit violence against another country, a critique of the gender politics of that war, thinking that in the play and again in our production we're trying to link expansionist aggression to masculinity, and a critique of the violence inherent in any military conflict, and that violence is counted in the cost of the French dead, but also in personal cost, because Henry ends up hanging one of his best friends from when he used to live in a gang in the East End. So the play, in Shakespeare's terms, looks at the, I would think of in some ways, the seduction and the dangers of leadership. And that, I hope, speaks to where we are now in the modern world and where we are in Britain, both in terms of how we got there historically and the kind of crises and dilemmas about leadership, national identity and global identity that we're all discussing now. And it does so in a way that is complicated, ambiguous and sort of weirdly upsetting and thrilling at the same time.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for giving us that overview. It's incredibly useful. Farah, you supported Max's production as a decolonising consultant. Can you tell us a bit about the conversations you both had before he started rehearsals?
Sure. Essentially, Henry V represents in the canon the sort of epitome of what I refer to as the Great White Bard. It's the play that people often use to sort of elevate national identity, as Max said so eloquently earlier. But there is an undercurrent in this play of critique, and it's also critiquing the sort of racial awareness that England was acquiring at the time. We often talk about race as something that is anachronistic when referred to the 16th century or prior to that. But actually, there's so much evidence that there was race and racial formation going on at this period, even though it wasn't named and sort of spuriously classified as it was in the 18th century to justify heinous acts thereafter. But the question is what is race in this play? And this play does some work towards defining it, particularly in the way in which English identity is seen as exceptional, the way whiteness is referred to as exceptional. Like, there are various levels of whiteness. And for example, the Irish and the Welsh will be dissociated from whiteness, right? So there is a particular kind of racial identity that England is aspiring to.
And I wonder, Indra, whether I can turn to you at this point to help us perhaps draw some threads between what Max and Farah have spoken about and your area of expertise. So can you help us link what I think of as the old power models built on colonialism and capitalism to the climate crisis? How do these things speak to each other, and can we begin to unpick them to imagine an alternative and perhaps even less harmful future?
Well, yes, absolutely. What I was hearing from both of you is something that I would recognise as a psychosocial therapist, as developmental. So you mentioned, Max, that you had a certain response to what happened in the play as an 11-year-old, and then you had a different response when you were a little bit older, and you saw through it in a different way. You know, that the way we might have heard it at the time of Shakespeare and the way that we're able to hear it now, these things have developed. Right. And so we've changed our way of looking at what happened historically because we are now able to. We're living in different times. It's to be able to recognize that there is developmentally, you know, a way of responding to the opportunity for power or for agency that looks a certain way at a certain point, you know, which means I would get my agency through overcoming or through overthrowing or for beating somebody else, right? And then you get older and you see it differently, that it's probably better to see it or to think about agency through listening to others, right? And through being able to create spaces for things to change. So if we can hold that in our minds when we then shift to the climate crisis, the developmental opportunity, right? This is how I would say it back. And it's political as well. That if once upon a time we thought that the way to progress was to extract from the earth, to kind of rape nature, to show ourselves as human over our environment, then maybe that's what we did for a period of time. But now we can see that that's destroyed. We've destroyed our own environment, that we are we're the authors of our own downfall, that we are now heading for the cliff. It's because we can see it differently. So now we can act differently. That's the way I would put it. And then the question is, how do we represent and invite people into new ways of acting, given that we now know that the relationship with nature is wrong? What is the new thing we can invite people into? So what is the adult self, you know, thinking about now what can we do to save the planet? Where is our strength and age? How can we be a man in this moment? All right, this I think is so central to what is going on in this play. How can we be a different kind of man in this moment?
Zoe, I wonder if I can turn to you and reflect on what we've heard so far.
Yes, I think what's really exciting is the sort of stitching these relationships between a play that was written at a point in history when it was just at the start of the colonial project, and that to hear how that sort of construction of national identity is kind of part and parcel of, you know, the othering occurs in order that the conquering can happen. So this sort of sense of idea of collaboration, how we move from a kind of conquering and colonial mentality to a collaborative one. And I think that's also very helpful, because when we're thinking, trying to think as theatre makers about new models of how we make and perceive and the kinds of stories we tell, we also can't go back. The question of, are we the tragic hero who goes down in flames and takes the planet with us, or are we on some kind of epic journey of transition where we can't see what's over the mountain, but we come from somewhere and we're going somewhere, we're navigating those in relation to one another rather than solo and on our own. And I wanted to ask you, Farah, to talk a bit about the position of Henry V in relation to the other Henry plays, because it seems to me that what we've inherited as Henry V as a standalone play, what you've told me previously, actually might have been slightly different at the time, that the ambivalences that we're now returning to might have been more present in the original experience of it.
Yeah, I mean, Shakespeare was writing these history plays together, essentially, so they would have been taken within context. So the first, before Henry V was written, you had the two Henry IVs, but then prior to that, you had Henry VI tetralogy and Richard III. So you had this kind of trajectory that we can look back on now as scholars and see what the context was where Henry V emerged from. But what we often do is we take it out of context, and that's happened for centuries, and that play has been held as a kind of space where English nationalism is one of the most important messages that comes out of that play, even though, as your production will prove, it is not the most important message necessarily. There are other messages that are emerging from that play. But the Henry VI plays were written already. So when Shakespeare's audiences went to see Henry V, they already knew what happened, and things kind of go downhill. there is this point where Shakespeare's kind of saying, well, let's look what happened in the middle. And actually in the middle, there was this moment of triumph. And we look back as Elizabethans, as, you know, trying to develop our own sense of identity and who we are. And we need to look back at this, and we need to see actually what happened here. And I think there are certain moments in the play where he is interrogating, he's asking questions about choices that you make as nations, as leaders. And actually what you were saying about collaboration, you know, what is our relationship to the countries that are within our most closest proximity? And so that it's really useful to put the play back into its context and to see that actually Shakespeare is not a toxic positivist. You know, he's not just constantly asking us to celebrate things. He wants us to sit in discomfort. And that is something that we find very difficult now, sitting in discomfort.
Gosh, that's an entirely new way of thinking about what Henry V is saying to the world. And for those of us who've been lucky enough to see Max's production, it feels like your reading of that is so true to Shakespeare's original.
That's what we've been trying to do, because there's one rather boring, old-fashioned production that just celebrates Henry's great English conquests. And then there's a kind of really straight anti-colonial critique production that just goes, everything he does is awful. But I think, in a way, if you don't explore the way in which we're attracted to these figures, there's no point in staging the violence, because if it's just pure judgment from the beginning, you don't get that push and pull. And I suppose that's why trying to ask people to sit with that is why we start the show with one of my favourite Walter Benjamin quotes, that there is no document of civilization that is not also at the same time a document of barbarism, to try and stress that it is both at the same time that there are wonderful things in the play, some amazing bits of poetry and language, but there is also horror in that, and that actually applies to almost everything too. You know, the same as our iPhones that we have on the table as we sit and have this conversation, that the iPhone is an object in some ways of civilization. It's a great achievement of human imagination and technology, but it is also an object of barbarism that causes, through the supply chains and where various minerals come from and the lack of equity in the employment of those people, that causes barbarism. So that all these cultural achievements have both human immense imaginative potential in, but also violence in them at the same time.
In fact, I was just thinking the same thing, but I was thinking you're pointing out the iPhone is actually exactly the kind of the nub of it, really. And there's a scholar, Rob Nixon, who talks about slow violence, which I think is also kind of key to us understanding how the kind of direct, obvious, active violence of one country invading another that's sort of hot and dramatic and visible connects to what Rob Nixon calls slow violence, which is much more about the way that the history of a kind of transactive, extractive capitalism has taken over different areas, countries, at times places. It encompasses deforestation, mining, the transfer of all of our ex-iPhones and all other electronic goods to east coast of Africa, that the recent climate conference that happened last November talks about how we have to stop. He says, enough of treating nature like a toilet, you know, enough of brutalising biodiversity. So we might not be obviously as a country going and colonising a new place, but there is nowhere now that human hand has not touched, and touched in order to extract or take or use for purposes other than are local to that place. So that's, for me, where, you know, when we ask the question, how do we make theatre about climate crisis when it seems so vast, when it's so enormous, when it's so globalised, when it's not necessarily at a surface level about people, because people often think environment, think of trees and so on. But actually, the climate crisis is all about people, because it's about how we behave and how, when I say we, I mean, you know, Western industrial modernity, and how that mentality has been exported across the world.
Time is very important here too, because one of the particularly difficult things about the climate crisis is it's asking us to take action now for a future. Because if the meteorological conditions of 20 years' time were now, it would be much easier for the world to come together and act. But in a way, just as climate crisis is asking us to imagine the future, one of the things art and looking at Shakespeare can do is to think back into the past. And somehow seeing things in a historical perspective links to what you were saying, Indira, about developmental thinking, but also helps us give us a broader context for understanding what's going on. And as I was coming in this morning, I was thinking in a funny way, Shakespeare and climate crisis feels like a very modern thing. It's like Mozart and scuba diving. Are they really in the same conversation? But actually, if you think about it, at the point when Shakespeare's writing is when these issues are first coming to be understood and first appearing in the world. And I was thinking about The Tempest this morning and the way in which that tells a story of a European man and family that comes to an island, probably somewhere in the Caribbean in some way, and he has a master-servant relationship with a figure, Caliban, who is something mythical and something of a First Nations person. And that's written about a lot, and there's lots of post-colonial writing about that. But one of the things that isn't often talked about is what task is Caliban given? Well, he's chopping down trees. He's deforesting the island. He complains about deforestation. And what is the thing that kicks off this whole play? Well, it's a freak nature event. It's a storm. It's a tempest. So the idea of Shakespeare is writing at the very moment when this connection of colonialism and human intervention in the planet are coming together and being crystallised. So actually, sometimes if you can look back into the origins of these processes and formations, you can not only have a better understanding of them in the present, but if you can see where they've come from, we might, thinking together, be able to get a more constructive conversation about how we can get a handle on them and steer them in the future.
Absolutely. I also think that because Shakespeare is the sort of popular figure that he is, that he's a great space to refract those issues through, because he is actually thinking about some of those intersections. That what you just said about The Tempest is absolutely spot on. And in fact, in this time period, there was a real anxiety about deforestation. People were worried about the number of trees that are getting cut down around London just in order to expand the city. So there were already pamphlets being published at this time about trees and holding on to nature and an anxiety about what's going to happen to the world if we continue to develop. So I think that's a really excellent point.
So it's in no way anachronistic to think about Shakespeare and the climate crisis.
Not at all.
It's absolutely part and parcel of the... Yeah, that's very useful.
One of the great things about Shakespeare is we're having these complicated and knotty conversations about quite difficult and serious issues in a text that is actually almost commercial. Like, lots of people will turn up and see it, and there aren't that many plays where you can get thousands of people through the door to have these conversations. What I've been learning over the last 10 years from scholars like Farah is that my original thinking of Shakespeare as being sort of universal. That's how I was taught it. He was a kind of universal genius, and he somehow spoke to everyone through his great imagination. Is not necessarily a helpful way of thinking about it, because even if there is extraordinary imagination in the poetry and richness and complexity in it, to claim that he's universal normalises one perspective, and it says that a white, male, British, probably middle-class perspective is a universal perspective. So that actually what one of the things we're trying to do in this production of Henry V is not to say that we kind of trash it or remove it, but to say that it's one perspective amongst others.
Yeah, I think that universality issue is a really big one. I mean, it's kind of a hot potato, I think, in the way in which people talk about Shakespeare sort of in popular media. And that idea of Shakespeare as the exceptional English genius came about in the 18th century, and that's sort of kind of stuck with us, right? That's what I'm writing about right now in my book called The Great White Bard, which might upset some people, but it's a really, I do love Shakespeare. I just want to get that out there. But I think what I don't love is that 18th century Shakespeare, that was sort of apotheosized as this amazing god-like figure that actually does represent the native genius of English and English identity. And so that's the Shakespeare everyone comes to see at the theater. Some people get upset when a production might be engaging with questions about colonialism and race and climate, because they might think, oh, those are issues for now. Well, I want to go back to my Shakespeare that I knew, right? And then that's where the space of discomfort. That's where you enter the space of discomfort and you feel like you can't sit there, because that's not what Shakespeare is for. But actually what we have to do is transform thinking about that too, right? And that actually the Globe Theatre sort of does that, because it is not a comfortable space to sit or stand. It's the very heartbeat of theatre making, which is discomfort.
As I'm listening, you know, what you're offering is, you know, is fantastic and so necessary. For me, it's like standing on a table while you're trying to lift it at the same time. You know, how do you actually get out of this universal idea when, as somebody reminded me yesterday, you know, Nelson Mandela on Robben Island used the collected works of Shakespeare as his Bible. You know, this is something, it's hard to accept that the thing we have to move away from is something that we have shared globally.
That's about his transportability, not about his universalism, I think. I think it's that Shakespeare is a movable feast, and he was at that time. You know, the plays are very fragmented, and they traveled around the country. They traveled out of the country, even at that time. So the transportability of them and the idea that you can relate to various characters.
Yeah, absolutely. But even the English language itself, you know, how do we get out from under it? Because it's become the universal language, right? I mean, I'm Indonesian myself, right? So I identify differently. When I've lived here most of my life, but I've never felt like a British citizen, let alone an English one. And yet I have to acknowledge that I was brought up speaking English. How do we get out from under that? It's very, very hard to achieve.
What's really interesting is that when Shakespeare was canonized in the 18th century, he was sort of separated from the theater. And if you look at all the statues that were sort of sculpted at the time of Shakespeare, he's resting on books and he's sitting in libraries and, you know, you get these busts that are like perfect neoclassical features, right? But that separation kind of took place then, and theater was very messy back then. And there were stages of sub-editing that the text
pretty
went
messy
through.
Now,
yeah, everybody was collaborating with Shakespeare to make these plays. You know, the actors, he was one of the only playwrights who was attached to a theater company. He was a sharer, he was a householder, which meant he had shares in the playhouse as well. And he was an actor and playwright attached to the company. That's an incredible amount of collaborative input that the folio just doesn't account for in any way, other than the fact that it was his friends that published it. So knowing the messiness of the text, that it was fragmented, that he may have written Act 3 before he wrote Act 1, that, you know, other writers like Thomas Middleton infiltrated the text from time to time, that he collaborated with John Fletcher and George Peel. So that in itself really does liberate Shakespeare from this idea of this monolith, you know, canonical author, that he was not sitting in some attic with a quill in Stratford-upon-Avon. He was in London with dirt under his nails writing these plays.
You know, I think it's really interesting because I think what you're also modelling there is what Indra, you talked about earlier, which is alternative ways of imagining and collaborating and operating. So like as you say, Max, it's already there in history if we only want to look at it, that actually it feels like the way forward isn't to go, well, I've got the solution and go out and, you know, conquer the climate crisis with it. But instead it's in these more complicated spaces of collaboration.
Well, that's the sort of Bill Gates thing. It's applying the Henry V logic to the climate crisis, isn't it? Like, I can be Henry V to the climate crisis and conquer it. Mm-hmm. And actually those kind of big money techno fixes seem increasingly unlikely to be the way that we're going to imagine a new society. It's actually mm-hmm. sort of more of the same, but with a kind of green hat on.
Yeah, and what it brings to my mind as a psychotherapist is that essentially there's this myth of any one of us as being a self, right? Like, I know myself, I am this. Whereas what you learn through studying the psyche is that each one of us is really a soap opera. We're a cast of characters, right? And that we have many different parts of ourselves, and that the only really good way to understand ourselves is to name the soap opera of the self. Because otherwise, even our own behaviour, we contradict ourselves. So when we think of the fragmented nature of everything, and yet there is still an essential, you know, something that you would stand for in the midst of all of that, you know, and what came out of history, you know, was the collected works of Shakespeare, and we now can pick it up, as you say, and refer to it as a Bible in some ways. But it's full of this fragmentation. And I think that's our task now, is to acknowledge the fragmentation, live in it, right? This is what you're describing. But don't let that add up to not being able to do anything.
Don't be Hamlet, in other words.
Don't be Claudius, because actually there's a really great moment where when we have knowledge of what's wrong, but we don't do anything, we can't let go of the spoils, right? That's that moment when he's praying, and then he's begging his body to just compel the emotion that he's meant to feel in that moment of, you know, redemption, or, you know, forgive me. But actually he can't do it because he doesn't want to let go of the thing that he won. And that's kind of, that kind of epitomizes this moment, because we do find out. We do know what we need to do. Mm. We've been told, and it's easy to find out what we need to do, but it's so hard to make those changes, to let go of comfort.
And I wonder if I can draw this conversation to a close whilst reflecting on some of the things we've spoken about. We've crossed enormous subject matter today. And I think we've just begun to think about where Shakespeare meets broader theatre making, meets decolonising our canonical texts, meets the climate crisis. We've just opened that door only ever so slightly. But I wonder if I could invite you all just to think about something you might take away from this conversation, something hopeful that you or someone listening in might be able to think about as a result of what we reflected on today, perhaps something that might lead a step towards a more positive future, where we might live in that fragmentation, where we might sit in the discomfort.
Well, I would hope that, I guess that in a culture that does sort of silo things into different categories, to invite someone to go away and think about the way these things join up, to think about the relationship between that sort of your sense of impotence when you're just doing your recycling, when you see another climate disaster on the news, and how those relate to them. Have a conversation with someone about the difficulty of holding those things in mind, because it's a slow process of us all working stuff out and not giving up. By opening up the conversation, we start to open up a different kind of space where we can see and pay attention to a different thing.
Thank you. Indra, how about you?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I've learned a lot more today about how Shakespeare could work and could be really useful in this process. And I suppose I would invite anyone to explore more and to sort of live with the fragmentation of their own self, but also maybe, you know, to take as much time as you just did through listening to this today, really on your own and acknowledging that fragmented self, but that also maybe finding something within that that unites all of these pieces and says, this is what I am and this is what I stand for. Because I think that's something you have to do on your own, is to learn to understand yourself and what you will stand for as you go into the future.
I guess it's thinking about the not feeling so powerless, right? I think sometimes when we are imagining the climate crisis and what our part is, that we feel powerless because there's so many larger factors in play that we can't seemingly do anything about. And I think Shakespeare's plays really teach you about the power and agency that we actually have as individuals. So I would think about maybe transforming that perspective.
Brilliant. And Max?
I think, listening to all of you, I feel increasingly that all violence is a failure of imagination. So if I am a Russian soldier and I shoot a Ukrainian soldier, ultimately that is in some senses because I cannot imagine the full humanity of the person I'm shooting. And likewise, the climate crisis is a failure of imagination. So the injustice we're doing to ourselves, future generations, other parts of the world, is our inability to imagine what it's really like for to be there and in that point. And so I think the arts and these sorts of conversations are a gym for our imagination, not helping us be fanciful and frivolous, putting curlicues and making kind of complicated pictures, but trying to imagine what it was like in the past, what it is like to be human now in all our varieties, and what it will be like in the future. And that imagination is our hope.
Thank you so much, Max, Farah, Indra and Zoe, for joining us today. And thank you everyone for listening. This has been Climate Conversations at the Donmar Warehouse. See you next time when we talk about our next production, Mary Seacole.